a pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming. So the way that we're going to run this panel is I'm going to shoot really hard questions to our amazing panelists, but before we start, we're just going to introduce ourselves to you. So we have Natalia Allen, Charlie Johnson, and Barbara Greenspan-Scheiman. And we're going to start with Natalia, who's going to share her introduction with you, why she's here today, and then we'll go around and loop back to me.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Natalia. I am a fashion designer trained at Parsons School of Design, which is in New York City. I graduated with the distinction of Designer of the Year in 2004. Immediately went to work for the industry as a design consultant, building brands and new products for the likes of Donna Karan and Calvin Klein and Saks Fifth Avenue. A couple of years into that, ventured out to develop my own independent clothing line. I also serve as a teacher of fashion business at Parsons, my alma mater, and belong to a number of cool organizations and have basically made it my life's work to combine doing good with building my company. Thank you.
Thank you, a gentleman and a scholar. I'm Barbara Greenspan-Scheiman, and I'm the baby boomer on the panel. And as I was reflecting about this introduction today, I thought about my life. I really learned my skill sets as a volunteer because in the 70s, women didn't have all these wonderful options we have today. And as I've evolved over the years, I was a teacher, I wrote curriculum, I marketed Häagen-Dazs ice cream, I did some very non-traditional things, and then got involved in the executive search world, having my own company. But I really realized that I needed to make a paradigm shift because in my life, I made decisions based on, first, my children and their welfare. Secondly, what opportunities were available to me at that point in time. And thirdly, what really filled my soul. In 1995, I was running a national executive search firm recruiting physicians, and I had an epiphany, which I'll share with you later, that I really needed to take all of my skills, my interests, and my passion and work with young people because violence and bullying are out of hand in this country and around the world. And coming in as a teacher and then having lots of life experience in terms of being organizational skills, public speaking skills, I decided I needed to shift my life around and I created a not-for-profit called Champions of Caring to promote social activism amongst youth, to create cultures of caring in schools and communities, to teach young people that silence and indifference is not an option and that we need safe schools for kids. 4 years ago, my husband, who was an estate lawyer, said to me, you know, this message should be shared with adults as well. And I started another venture called Embrace Your Legacy, where I try to reach out to people and show them how they can take their passions, their skills, and their interest and start addressing important societal issues and, more importantly, pulling in family members, colleagues, people from their faith-based community so that they can really live what I think is a rich and meaningful life. And each one of you has that ability today. It's about harnessing the passion and having the plan to make it work.
Charlie Johnson, born and raised Salt Lake City. Very simple person, so this will be very quick. Had a business at 15. It was my way to, it was my excuse not to date, to go to dances. Worked my business, fell into the same thing everyone did with TV and advertisement. I thought if I got the house, the car, the money, I'd be happy. I did everything I possibly could to get that, got it, was severely unhappy. Left my business about 18 months ago, a very successful manufacturing company of about 260 employees. Decided not to go back to the corporate world, and for the last 18 months, we have committed to the Pay It Forward movement, traveled the world, and we are sitting here today.
Thank you. And I'm Rachel Chong. I'm the founder and CEO of Catch a Fire, which is an online platform similar to an eHarmony or a Match.com of sorts, but what we're matching is we're matching professionals who have specific skills in areas such as marketing, finance, technology, social media, design, you name it. We're taking professionals who have their professional skills and we're matching them with pro bono opportunities, so specific project-based opportunities with nonprofits and social enterprises, and we're matching you based on your skill set and your cause interest. So the reason why we're doing this is twofold. One, on the side of nonprofits, the statistic is that 95% of nonprofits say that they need and want access to pro bono services, but they don't know where to go to get it. That means 95% of nearly 2 million nonprofits in America don't know where to get talent. So we're trying to help fill that gap and solve that problem by helping them access this great talent through people who want to actually give their time and their skills pro bono. So on the other side of the equation, for professionals, we want to make it really easy for people to access meaningful and impactful and, most importantly, delightful volunteer experiences, because it's actually really darn hard to give your professional skills. And why should it be? And so the statistic on that side is actually pretty shocking. You have a 60% volunteer dropout rate in America. And what that means is that in 2010, 63 million Americans volunteered. But in 2011, 60% of those did not volunteer again the next year. And that's pretty staggering. There are many reasons why this is the case, but the reason that Catch a Fire is battling is the fact that nonprofits don't always know how to provide volunteers with great experiences. And if you don't have a great experience, and if the nonprofit's not helping you use your time effectively in a meaningful way, why would you do that again? Nobody wants to waste their time. So we're trying to make it possible for people like you who have your time is your most precious resource, that it's used well. And then when we connect you to that nonprofit organization, you're able to use your skills, and it's meaningful and delightful and potentially transformational. So that's me, and that's Catch a Fire. First question to our esteemed panelists. How are you using your skills to make a difference? So you've shared with us what you do, and how is that actually translating into doing good? Barbara, can you start us off?
Well, for me, my passion for youth was really what drove me to create Champions of Caring. I cared very much about the next generation and trying to ensure that they would have a safer life, a life without bullying and violence. And I took the organizational skills and the public speaking skills that I had garnered in business and transitioned them, because your skills are transferable. And sometimes we think we're trapped in the job that we're doing right now. But I really began to reflect upon my life and thought, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, my kids are in college, this is now my time to really look at what do I want to do with my life. And I think it's really about understanding what your strengths are, what are your weaknesses, who do you need to support you? That's the most important part of this whole deal, I think. What do you not know? Because starting a 501c3 not-for-profit requires so many skill sets. And I had to really do an introspective reflection about where am I strong, where am I weak, how do I surround myself with the people that can give me the skill sets to empower me to get to my vision.
Thank you. Charlie? So I want to know, you know, after many years of building this successful manufacturing business, how are you using those business skills now to do good?
I would assume that most people in this room are kind of in the same position. You have certain skills. They work no matter what you're doing. The skills I'm using is just experience, dealing with people, knowing when to say something, when not to say something, when to be silent. Just keeping, and actually, I most of the stuff I learned in my 15 years with my manufacturing company, to basically do the opposite. That's it. I mean, Einstein says doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, is the definition of insanity. We need something different. So I'm learning from some of the experience we had for the last 15 years, but basically looking at what we did as a corporation and kind of wanting to change things up. Did I confuse anybody? No? Okay, perfect.
So as a designer, I am pretty much working within the context of just designing apparel and retailing it, and how could that possibly be any good for anyone? I would back up and say that while working as a consultant, I traveled the world and was able to visit factories and witness how garments were made, which included watching the dye process and how the chemicals were released into rivers, and then watching how the workers were, you know, laboring but not treated at all ethically, fairly, humanely. And while I was developing really cool products for, you know, world-renowned brands, I sort of had a conflict of interest, if you will. There was my own personal trajectory and being an award-winning designer, and, you know, how my life skills and my talents were going to make a difference. And so I left the consulting world because of my personal experience. It was very, very tough to see people not be able to feed their children, you know, in order for a garment to come to market at a price that was ridiculously low. So I took my skill sets to the points made earlier, which are frankly developing textiles, developing products, creating brands, and created a brand using new technology, which allowed me to develop my products domestically, which gave me the opportunity to create jobs in America, also to control the quality of life of my workers and the facility in which they're working in. I took extreme attention to detail in terms of the textiles and making sure that everything was certified ecologically on the highest global level, so, you know, according to the European Commission. And, you know, so basically transferring the skills that I used in the for-profit world and taking that to still the for-profit world, but being able to align my value set with my skill set is how I think that, you know, I'm trying to do good as a designer.
Garner and say that you're interested in coming to this panel because you're interested in using your skills that you have right now in your current job, your free time, to make a difference? Can you raise your hand?
So much free time.
Well, that's amazing. My mic is not on. Okay, I'm going back to the microphone. Thank you. All right, great. So I am going to speak to the majority, if that's okay, with the minority, and I'm sure you'll get something out of it as well. The second question I have is, you know, what was the inspiration and what was the impetus behind thinking about how to use your skills in alignment with your values? So the story behind the work that you're doing now.
This is very personal and very emotional for me. My mother is the sole survivor of a family of 65 people. Her entire family was massacred during the Holocaust. My father worked for Oskar Schindler, and if you saw Steven Spielberg's film, that was the basis of the film. My entire life, I heard about genocide, and what inflamed me was that there was more genocide happening all over the world, and that we were watching it on our television sets. I did a lot of volunteer work for many years as I was creating my own career, raising my children. And then in 1990, I went to Auschwitz with my mother. And on that trip, when I saw the horrific things that human beings can do to each other, I had an epiphany that I needed to change my life around. That it was not enough to be an entrepreneur, but that I needed to use my skill sets to change the world and to work with young people and to teach them that silence and indifference are diseases, that they must stand up and speak up, that we need to create schools that promote cultures of caring, where there's kindness and caring and compassion. And we need to teach young people that they can, in fact, address important societal issues. Because young people have tons of passion. They just don't know how to harness that passion. So I figured out if I could create a toolkit to show them how to do it, that maybe we could really have impactful and sustainable change. And I'm very proud to tell you, over the past 18 years, we've worked with 10,000 kids in this city. And some of them come from the most impoverished backgrounds. But never sell a young person short, because they have so much in their heart. They've learned so much from the hard lives they've led. But you give them the tools, and they can change this world in very, very impactful ways.
Charlie, what's your story?
There was no aha moment. It was just months and months and months of watching people and how they treated each other. I didn't like what I saw. I just didn't like what I saw. And I felt the only way to do something to make this world a better place was to lead by example. So we made a change. I mean, it's as simple as that. We have an ungodly amount of choices in this world, yet we only have two political choices. That's another story. I think there are tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people on this planet that want to do good. They simply just don't know what to do. I think we need simplicity in a complex world. I think we need that human connection in an all-digital world. And I just felt that what we're doing today brings both of those back. And I wanted something that was neutral. I wanted something that every single human on the face of this planet could be a part of. And that's what we're doing. So no aha moment. I just think we need to treat each other just a tiny bit nicer.
And Charlie, can you tell us what exactly are you doing? What are you working on?
How many in the room have heard of the Pay It Forward movement? Or have seen the movie or read the book? That movie changed me. The movement has been around a lot longer than the book and the movie. It's been around for thousands of years. I still cannot figure out what the origin of it is. No one has ever given a direction. It's been an idea. It's been a thought. It's been something people do on a day-to-day basis. Most of you do it even though you don't even know what you're doing. To bring that to the forefront, to let the world know we have an organization, that there's a person that can come up, do a panel, do a Skype assembly, travel the world, do talking, speaking, whatever, has really gave us immense momentum. Again, it's simplicity. The only thing we're asking anyone we speak with is to be just a tiny bit nicer than they were the day before. Nothing grand. I don't want you to change your job, change your diet, nothing grandiose. Just imagine if hundreds of millions of people woke up tomorrow and just were a tiny bit nicer. Next time someone cuts you off, instead of flipping them off and honking your horn, what if you didn't do that? What if that door you forgot to hold was held? What if that smile that you got from someone was returned? We simply do not have any idea how we are on our way to work or on the way to school, the hundreds of people we cross paths with, how we impact their lives. We need to understand that.
What is your story? What was your inspiration behind all of the good work you're doing?
So I think I spoke to this a little bit earlier, but just working as a designer and as a consultant, I think it's important to note that normally when you're creating clothing, you're inside a studio, you are basically working in front of a computer, and everything is being made, on the other side of the world. So because I was working as a consultant and responsible for the entire supply chain and the entire life cycle of development, I had to actually go and meet and work, on the same floor of the factory workers and in the dye houses of the textile mills. And it was this process that basically informed me how awful the industry really was on a very practical level. And it was something that my education totally missed. There was a gap there. And I think just as many of you, I have a value set, and that the way the practices were in my industry didn't align with my value set. And I sit here today to say that I've been able to align my value set with the types of products I'm developing and the way that I'm developing some points that I mentioned earlier. But I think it's also important to note that it wasn't easy, right? It wasn't sort of like, okay, so I'm done with this consulting thing and all the money that I was able to earn doing that, and now I'm just going to go be, you know, philanthropic, feel good, and save the world through my clothing. It was a very practical, diligent, studious process where I had to not only identify how to be competitive in a marketplace where people didn't exercise their values, and how to market and how to brand and how to develop and, you know, where the capital would come for that. But I assure you that I have zero regrets for leaving the fanfare of being a part of, you know, prestigious collections to develop something very humbly, but something that's very much aligned with the vision I see and the way I want people to work and what the things that I want people to wear. So just to, I'm sure you're going to talk about this soon, but I'd like to get to the practicality of how, for those folks who are here who want to actually shift gears, and what it's like to leave your job and leave a lofty position, a lofty salary, and go out and do something, you know, kind of adventuresome.
That will be our next question. Thank you. And so my story, Catch a Fire, came from many experiences that I've had. I actually was very fortunate to grow up all over the world. My mother is an Australian diplomat, so from the age of 8, I've been living in different countries all over Asia. And I remember moving from Australia to China when I was 8 years old, which was right after the Tiananmen Square incident, which was a really interesting time to be in China. To see the poverty and the disrepair of this country that was just emerging into the global sphere. And at that moment, I knew that what I wanted to do was figure out why and then help affect the change so that, you know, there was more equity. You know, when you're 8 years old and you come from the first world to the third world, it's rather shocking. So that was my backdrop. I later came to the United States for college, so I went to Columbia. And right after that, I went into investment banking. And it actually did make sense to go into investment banking. And the reason why that did make sense with this desire from 8 years old to want to help create equal opportunity for all was that I saw that there was a very big opportunity to use the market and to use business to figure out how to make social good at a very large scale. So I wasn't interested in just working for one nonprofit. I was interested in figuring out how do you use the most powerful force in our world today, which is the market, to create massive social change. So I thought that I needed education in this market, and so I went into investment banking. And it was a very challenging experience because I was putting myself in an environment that was very different from the type of person that I am. So I was surrounding myself with people who were very unlike me for this education that I wanted to give myself. And what I learned was that these people were actually very similar to me. And that despite the fact that, you know, they, for some reason, were motivated very much by the competition of making lots and lots of money, the similarity was that in every one of my peers, there was the desire to give back and to do good and to use these skills and, you know, this privilege that one has to contribute back to the community and to the world at large. And so that was very eye-opening for me. I also tried to volunteer my skills while I was on the job. I tried to volunteer these newly minted finance skills, and I found that it was really, really hard to do that. So I spent 6 months every single day going to every website that I could find that had to do with finding volunteer opportunities. And there are really great ones out there, and you may have heard of some of these. Volunteer Match, Idealist, All for Good. But the challenge was, how do you actually find a volunteer opportunity where you can use your skills? That was what was really hard. And after 6 months of trying to find something without any luck, I mean, that was a seed of thought. I was like, why is it so difficult to give what you're good at? I didn't know I was going to go and found Catch a Fire. Instead, what I did was after I got my education in banking, I went into the nonprofit sector, and I helped to start up a nonprofit organization. While I was there, I learned the power of pro bono and how important and effective it is to help build capacity for social good organizations. So I started this nonprofit and used pro bono. It was just two of us that started it, and I used nine professionals across many different areas, marketing, technology, strategy. And what that did was it freed up my time and the CEO's time to focus on what the nonprofit had to do. And we were able to raise $40 million in 9 months. And my learning from that was the power of using people's passions and their skills, again, to help build capacity in this social good organization that we were building, which was called BRAC USA. And that was then the other side of the equation. And then I just put the two and two together, realized that there was nothing that was connecting the talent to the need. And I'm now building that marketplace, which is now the largest online pro bono service provider, where we serve 2,500 organizations and 10,000 professionals to date. And that's still the very beginning for us, but it's a start. So that's my story. And turning it back to Natalia's excellent question, which was, how do you, with this idea to do good, how do you actually take the leap and do this, practical, diligent work to make it happen? Because it isn't easy, for instance, Charlie, to leave your company of 210 people that you built and is very lucrative to go and, help, I guess, define the pay it forward movement. And then for you, Natalia, to start your company, what does it take to align your values with your skill sets? That's the question. What does it take to align your values with your skill sets? And if you can offer the audience one piece of really good practical advice on doing that, I think that would be really helpful. Does anyone want to start? Well, he's putting you on the spot, so.
He goes next.
Do you accept the challenge?
Happily. I mean, we're just, we're sharing here. You can't go wrong.
That's true.
It was as much an exercise in faith and courage and conviction as it was in mathematical diligence, right? So raising capital, which meant that I had to have a very clear vision for the business, which was defined with milestones, and basically I stopped accepting job offers one day and stopped working with new clients and slowly let existing clients go. So I let the air out of one business while I was apprenticing. Actually, I had an apprenticeship with a technology firm and learning basically the state-of-the-art manufacturing capabilities for automated production. And I volunteered that time to basically learn about a breakthrough technology which would allow me to start a business that would be competitive in the 21st century. And I think the context for that scenario is that most products are made overseas. And in order to make things domestically, you have to have very strong strategic advantages. Otherwise, you're sort of setting yourself up for, I would just say, difficulties. And so it was a very, it was as much a exercise in like conviction, and this is what I believe, and this is the way I want to see the country go, and these are the way products should be made. And equally, all right, so how do we get this done? How much capital do we need? Where are those resources? What is the potential for this business? What where do we find the human potential? Like, who are the people who are going to work on the business? So I think that was, you know, in as much as a step-by-step way I could explain. And it took time. I would say that it took, the entire process of transitioning took a year and a half just to manage expectations in the room. It wasn't, you know, okay, I'm done, next. It really took a year and a half of steady development.
Thank you.
I personally feel like a part of the crowd. I've only met these three in a phone call, and I love listening to these stories that I can't even compare to. But for the 10% of the room that raised their hand that said they wanted to make a change, all I could suggest is you can't become who you want to be until you let go of who you are. There has to be a drastic change. I would agree with everything. I stopped accepting job offers. I was in a Blockbuster parking lot with my wife. I didn't know how to tell her that the last offer that I was going to say no to, that was going to make life on her and I very easy. She kicked open the door. It took about 2 weeks to tell her this. I decided to tell her that. I said, hey, honey, I did not accept the last offer. I was expecting to get my ass kicked. She shut the door, looked at me, and said, okay. You can't ask for anything more than that. I am the polar opposite of everyone on this panel. I can't stand structure. I did not ask any of these questions that any of these three have asked. So I would assume this room is more structured. For the few probably that are not, it's as cliche as hell, but your heart knows where to take you. And I lived at home till I was 28. 1 year of that was with my wife now, who was my girlfriend at the time, sharing a wall with my parents in a 950-square-foot house. I'm a mama's boy. I love security. But at a certain point in your life, you can only take so much. And if you're miserable, then make a frickin' change. You have to make a change. I'm assuming most people in here have kids and you want this planet to be better for your kids. You have to do something about it. So this room is full of people who care about that change. You came to this room to listen to us for bits of inspiration. This room will not be changed by the huge conglomerates or by the government or by the wealthy. It's going to be changed by from the bottom up. So you know what you want to do. You just need to do it. This world is full of talk and needs more action. So I don't even know if I answered the question for you, but that's what came to my mind, so I that's how I answered. But again, I'm not that structured, so I you know what you want to do. Just go for it and see what happens. If you fail, then move on to something else.
I'll piggyback on that. For me, I was involved in a business venture that I never thought I could have, running a company, recruiting doctors, and it was satisfying. But I really realized that to fill my soul, I needed to make a change, and that it would be empowering for me to start to address challenges that I saw as huge in our society. Because if our children are not raised in a world that cares, that shows kindness, that shows compassion, that teaches them that they can, in fact, make a difference with their lives, I think we fail miserably. And for me, that challenge of taking on, how can we solve violence in schools? How can we work with teachers to teach them to create environments that are caring and compassionate? How can we give people the skill sets to really change what they don't like? It's about conquering our own fears and saying, my life is more important than me and my pocketbook and what I need. We need to give back to this earth. That's why I think we're on this earth. Where is the meaning? Where is the purpose? And as I started reflecting on my life, I realized I really needed to turn it around and look at, what can I do to make it better? And I didn't have delusions of grandeur. I thought, you know what? If I fail, at least I'm doing something that might have great merit. And I can tell you that if you dream big and in technicolor, but you take small guarded steps and you put people around you who are safe, who believe in your mission, who are not naysayers. If I can give you one bit of advice, avoid the naysayers. They will pull you down. Surround yourself with smart people who can challenge you, but will also say to you, that's great. You didn't get that grant? No problem. We're going to be there for you. You need a lot of support. To run a 501c3, not for profit, forgive me, is you got to be a little crazy and driven. And able to take no. I have been rejected so many times in my life, just pick myself up and keep on trucking, because the cause is greater than the person.
Thank you. So what I'm hearing, some themes that we all have here are that failure doesn't keep us back from moving forward, so that's important. Big dreams, but small steps, and learning from others, and also creating that network of support for the work that you're trying to do. I just want to talk about a couple of things in what has been mentioned here, and that is failure and also small steps. So for me, I think, you know, there are many, many more entrepreneurs. There are many entrepreneurs that are smarter than me, that are better than me in every way. But I think the one thing that I have that has taken me to this point and hopefully far beyond it is the fact that failure is not scary to me. And that's an interesting thing to understand. But I think it's actually really critical. I think of every failure as an opportunity to learn and an opportunity to grow. And I think that if we look at falling down in that way, it just makes us able to continue on, and not only that, to build on that mistake that we made. So in my company, as an example, so I have 25 people working for me now, and every week we come together in our weekly priorities meeting. And then in this meeting, you know, with 25 people, it's enough people where it's challenging to allow everybody to speak, because everybody wants to have airtime, and that meeting can drag out. But the one thing that everyone has an opportunity to talk about in this meeting is their best mistake. So we go around the room, and every week, each member of the team, from the most junior to the most senior person on the team, shares that one mistake that they've made, and the learning from that mistake. And so what we're trying to do by talking about it and by celebrating it is to create a culture where it's totally okay to fail. It's not okay to make the same mistake twice, but it's okay to fail, because we know that if we fail, if we learn from that, we will be that much stronger. And I think that's also the point about small steps to make a change. I don't think that it's common to have a Charlie moment, to be honest, where, you know, you are in the you're in the parking lot, and the next day, you know, your life has taken a different turn. I think that more often we see perhaps the Natalia path, where it takes years of, well, only a year and a half, which is quite fast, but, you know, diligent effort. Okay, so then maybe that doubles it to 2 years. But, you know, diligent effort and conscious, intentional effort to make the change. And my one tip is, while you're taking those small steps, if you're gentle with yourself and if you see your failures as an opportunity to learn, it makes it that much easier. So the next question that I have is, why is giving back one's time and skills important and different versus giving one's money? Barbara.
I think the joy of shaping your time, taking your inner passion, your vision for what you want to do, is so enriching because you learn so much about yourself. It's one thing to write a check and to direct it to something. It's a whole other thing, whether you're birthing a child like we did or being a volunteer, that you know your imprimatur is on this.
What'd you do? Oh, you didn't. Oh, sorry.
How come there's a man on this panel? It's really wonderful to know that you can shape it, that you have the joy of getting involved with a family or a child, and you see the recipient. This is not charity, by the way, because you get so much more than what you give, but to see the look on someone's face when you've brought them what whatever endeavor you're in, if you're teaching an inner city kid to play tennis, or if you're visiting a child in a hospital who has autism, the joy, the gratitude, there's no price on it. It's, you know, that MasterCard, it's priceless. So to get hands-on and dirty and then to pull in your friends and your family, it's incredible. It is so enriching. I don't think there's anything that I do that gives me greater pleasure than reaching out to someone else, seeing a smile on their face, and then feeling that joy of, I was part of that in some way.
Can you give me that one more time? Why is it good to give you time rather than money?
Yeah, so why is it better to... No, I didn't use the word better. Actually, you can tell me if you think it's better, but I said, you know, why is giving back one's time and skills different than giving money?
Gotcha. Okay. The government, the wealthy, the corporations cut massive checks year after year, hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, to solve the world's largest problems, and they continue to get worse. Yes, there are the fair amount or a small one here and there that does get solved, or a disease gets eradicated, or something happens. But if you look at stats, and most of our world's problems are getting worse. Again, Einstein, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, is the definition of insanity. We are insane. Money is not going to solve this world's problems. 7 billion people doing just a tiny bit better than they did the day before is going to solve the world's problems. There's enough in this world to solve the world's problems. My opinion. Time, human connection, the ability to do something and be a part of a movement, of a part of a cause, of a part of a cure, whatever it may be, is much more powerful than handwriting a check, giving it to someone, and not knowing where that money goes. I don't personally think money is needed, but money and gigantic chunks of change are not going to solve the world's problems. People are. So time... And again, just bringing back that desperate need for the human connection is what's going to solve these world's problems.
My philosophy on these things is not quite as extreme. I tend to think that we don't exist in either or. We need both the capital and you need both the talent, right? So that, you know, you give what you have. If resources monetarily are what you have to give, then by all means, if that's your blessing, share it. If your gift is teaching, if it's art, if it's, you know, the something in the legal profession or otherwise, then share that. I think the continuity in all of our comments is that just be thoughtful and attentive and be willing to share that with others. I think it's whatever it is you have plenty of, be able and available to give to others. You know, but that's a personal philosophy, so I don't know that I have any position to tell anyone what to do.
Thank you. I agree with the concept of, you know, share what you have in abundance. But to answer, you know, the question more directly, the difference between giving time and skills versus money, in my opinion, the biggest difference is that when you give your time and your skills, you gain an experience. And that's really different from giving money. You don't often get an experience back when you give money, but when you give your time and your skills, you get something back. So Barbara said, you know, this is not charity. Volunteering is not charity. This is an interesting concept. That resonates with me because the idea of charity is that you just give and you don't get anything in return. Whereas with volunteering, what I think you should expect is an experience that will change you. And if that is because it'll change you because you are now empowered in that you see that that time that you're giving, those skills that you're giving really can change other people's lives and make a difference, that is very empowering. Or even if it's, you know, you're giving your time and your skills so that you can, you know, volunteer with your friends and make those connections, those human connections that Charlie talks about that are so important, or if you're giving your time and your skills because you want to build on those skills that you're learning on the job, and you want to apply them to another type of environment, and that's simply because you want professional development and growth, good for you. If you're giving your time and your skills because you want to meet new people, fantastic. But the difference in my mind is that when you give your time and your skills, you get something back. And there's something, I think, extremely, there's something incredible about that, because you're being really efficient and effective. You're killing two birds with one stone. You're doing good and you're getting something back. Like, this is an amazing thing. Please.
So I totally agree with everything Rachel said. I would just add to it that you also receive when you give monetarily, you know, and that's why it ought not be an either or scenario. Some people will be able to give both of their finances and of their time. Others will have to make a choice, but I think that they both carry value and they both benefit the receiver and the giver. And, you know, if the point is that most folks are skewed towards giving exclusively financially, then I totally appreciate all the comments that were made. But I think that, you know, you can't start businesses. There has to be fluidity with capital. Mm-hmm. There has to be, you know, it's not that the world needs more money, but the money has to move more mm-hmm. equitably. So that's why I think, you know, the scales are quite even when it comes to experience as well.
Rachel, I'd like to piggyback on that. I do a lot of work with intergenerational families, and maybe the matriarch or the patriarch is used to writing that big check, and God, we need those big checks. But maybe the children or the grandchildren are vested in doing the work. So let's say they're endowing a music department for an inner city school that lost all their funding. And all of a sudden, the children or grandchildren want to be part of this and be hands-on. But the grandfather wrote the check to empower them. So I think you need all of these pieces. Everybody does what they're able to do at that stage of life. And you can pull together an entire team by having the person write that check and then the person actualize the vision.
Great, thank you. So I agree. I think it's important on both sides. Tying this back to you know, the topic of this panel, which is using your skills to make a difference. We've talked about giving. We've talked about, you know, giving money versus giving time. We've talked about how hard it is or how easy it is to actually align your values with your skills. Just to wrap it up before we open it to the audience for Q&A, what is that one piece of practical advice for the people in this room who want to use their free time to make a difference? And so if this is a tip, such as where to go to find that opportunity, great. Again, please try to give a piece of practical advice.
She's looking at me. I think for me, it's about really being introspective and reflecting on what your passion is. Follow that passion. If it's something that really resonates with you, try to find a place where you can actualize your vision around the passion, whatever it is, and surround yourself with very supportive people who are like-minded, have a similar vision, and want to be on that journey with you. Interview boards. Don't just sit on a board. If you want to volunteer, look at what their mission statement is. See if you're going to be valued as a member of that board. I have candidly resigned from a lot of boards because they don't want to hear my opinion. You know, you don't want to keep going to these meetings, articulate a view, and then you don't see them taking that on in a serious way. So I'm fine with that. Maybe they should find someone that's more like-minded. I don't take that as a downer. I see it as I'm valuing my time. Go where you can grow, where your input is invaluable, and where you are with people that you enjoy. That's a formula for really success, and don't forget avoiding the naysayers.
I'm a better person for being on this panel from listening to these guys. I'm starting to understand I need to be more detail-oriented desperately. I'm just a very simple person. I think, my answer is going to be very quick. There's enough talk. The world needs more action.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I don't know what else to say.
It's a good one.
I'm going to move over.
I think the piece of advice that I often dish out generously, if you will, is to not wait for things to be perfect. You know, there is these false constructs that we create in our mind. I will when, ... And I think that if you are fortunate enough to know and have a passion or a vision or an idea of what your gifts are, just start. If it's in your family, if it's in your community, if it's in your job, if it's in your city, in your country, on the other side of the world, whatever have you. But I think to just tune out this idea of like a perfect construct and start with what you have. And it's amazing to watch something grow.
Can I say one more thing?
Please.
What she said. That's perfect. We've skipped across some amazing people from the bottom to the top in this past 2 years, and I can't begin to tell you how many people are waiting for things to be perfect until they make that next step. Make the damn next step and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. There is never a perfect time.
And then just to piggyback on that, so take the step, even if it's not perfect. And then when you think about what is that step, I think, again, back to failure and to learning, look at safe places to learn. And volunteering is a really safe place to learn. Any place that you can find where you can apply those skills in an environment where it's not going to jeopardize your job, it's not going to jeopardize your family, it's only good, there's only upside. So take and identify opportunities where there's no downside and there's only upside for you to learn and grow. And use those opportunities for that. And then, you know, with each step, new opportunities will emerge and take those as they come. So, to you, what questions do you have for us? Will you actually help me and go to the microphone in the middle of the room so that people can hear you? Thank you.
No problem.
And if you can also share your name and you know, something interesting about yourself, that would be great.
Hello? Okay.
Oh, what happened
Thank
to
you.
The clock?
I had a question for Natalia.
Hi.
Okay. Hi, my name is Beverly Oliver. I work for the Department of Public Welfare, but in that kind of structure, there's a lot of things I have a passion for that doesn't fit into that box. And you mentioned you were teaching. I was wondering if you had the freedom to share your passion in your academic role. Is something you had to argue for, or nobody cares whether or not you do it?
It was a situation that a former professor basically approached me and really wanted to bring, I guess, my perspective into the school. But for many years, the university had, I would say, avoided discussing sustainability and these types of entrepreneurial initiatives. But I do it purely to share. To give back. I mean, that's one of the ways that I'm able to, I suppose, share some of the bumps in the road so that others can avoid it. And, you know, give people a different vision for their possible career. Because mine is just one way, right? There are many others.
You have freedom
to a degree. But mm-hmm. I never look at the outlines. I tend to look at what it is I'm trying to create more than the box it's in.
Thank you. I have a question for Barbara. You had mentioned that you have worked with about 10,000 school children in Philadelphia. Can you tell us what you actually did with them and give us some examples of how your Champions of Caring improved them or improved a situation?
Yeah, thank you. What we do is train teachers in our pedagogy. We combine character education and service learning. Any of you educators in the room? And what we want to do is create cultures of caring. So we train administrators and teachers and superintendents in this model because I believe that unless there's an environment that is warm and supportive, young people will not thrive. And the curriculum we've put together combines both of these teaching styles, but also gives toolkits for young people to start to address important issues in their lives and gives them the responsibility to take this on. And it's very interesting. You know, we talked on the phone about service learning and why this is an important way to teach. The research has shown that even with kids who are not doing well academically, if you have them find their own passion, create their own project, start doing the research, have to learn organizational skills and all the kinds of skill sets to empower them to be successful, they feel better about themselves and in turn they do better academically. So I believe that this is a very strong pedagogy and should be used with lots more kids because the most important thing we can give young people is hope and tools to have a better life.
Sharing your experiences. I have to say that this panel is such a very comprehensive and inspiring panel, so I appreciate you sharing. I'm a daughter, sister, mother. That's who I am. Several years ago, I took my six-year-old son backpacking throughout Europe because I just graduated grad school, and I said, before I jump into this rat race, let me go and travel because that's what I love to do. So we did that, and it was scary, very scary. But I knew that it would feed both of us, and we would do good for others. So we did a lot of volunteer work in Italy, and we were in Paris and London. It was just such an enriching experience. So we came back, and in our spare time, we have volunteered. But I'm finding throughout these years of being back that I loathe this lifestyle. I'm part of the 10%, by the way, not wanting to do it in my spare time. I want to live it. I want to be a change agent for peace. However, going back to who I am a mother. So for my 12-year-old son, I want to make sure that I still can keep him in the private school and live that lifestyle. So I'm really struggling with how I'm able to live this passion that I have within me, but also make sure it's my responsibility to maintain the safety for my child. So I appreciate, Rachel, you saying you're not scared of fear. And although I find myself to be a very tenacious person, when it comes to my child, I need it to be safe because he's not able to fight it off. So that's my question, or if you have any advice of how I'm able to reconcile that.
Thank you for your question. And I apologize to the people behind you because we actually won't be able to take your questions, but we'll be here. So if you want to come up and talk to us afterwards, would anyone like to address this last question? And thank you for it. Please, Natalia.
I can at least speak to one point. I don't have a child, but I would just say this. It's not easy, and there are sacrifices that have to be made. And what you're going to give up in terms of your comforts, you're going to gain in terms of your purpose and your centeredness and your thoroughness, your happiness with your life. So I gave up a lot of worldly comforts, if you will. I didn't have a child, you know, and I certainly wasn't without the things I needed. But I made a decision that a lot of things that other people perceived as needs and as desires were not as important as me living confluently, as me living a life where I worked
and my work produced something that was good, not only for myself, but for others. And so I just encourage you to think about what are the things you can do without, and then think about, you know, how you can provide for that, how you can fulfill that need doing what it is you believe in, which is clearly peacemaking. And so maybe it's not private school, but there's a school district that's public, which is sufficient, it's adequate, and it provides your child with what he needs. I can't make those decisions, but I just encourage you to think about it as, yes, there will be a sacrifice, and what are the trade-offs I'm willing and are okay to make?
I think that's a perfect way to end. Thank you. It was a pleasure being here with you.